But you know, it's not necessary per se to have superconducting material to do an NMR, but you need an intense magnetic field. And the only practical way to generate a strong enough magnetic field is with superconducting materials.
Yeah, that's a roger. So the liquid helium is actually capable of bringing the temperature down to that critical point just above absolute zero?
Well, I mean, it's not like Bose-Einstein condensates that I mentioned a couple of weeks ago, where you have to get it to about a trillionth of a degree above absolute zero. Again, I'm not quite sure, but I wouldn't be surprised if it was something like 7 or 10 degree Kelvin, where the material is superconducting, perhaps higher. I'd have to look it up. But, I mean, it certainly is doable. I mean, it causes all kinds of problems when you want to shut it down. Occasionally, idiots bring metal objects into the room, and it flies across the room. Occasionally, guns have been known to be brought into the NMR machine. So, you know. And helium does weird things. Years ago, I mentioned that there was this problem people were having with the mechanisms, these micro devices that are in our cell phones. When helium from an MRI machine leaks out a little bit of it and it gets into the workings of an iPhone, it kills the iPhone for a couple of days until you let time just have the helium escape out of it.
That's interesting. Well, yeah, I have at least one story from hospitals where a metallic oxygen tank was inadvertently brought in and became a missile. Yeah, but in any case, yes. Yeah, so it does cool it to that degree. I think the metal that's used in the MRI machine is niobium and titanium. I believe that's it. The other interesting thing, if you look into the actual workings of this thing, is these Cooper bonds, as they're known, when two electrons weakly pair with one another and occupy the same proximal space, which is also another quantum mind-bending fact. But, yeah, I'm just beginning to get my head around these things.
Okay, very good. According to Google, they use something called niobium titanium alloy, and it becomes superconducting at 9.4 degrees Kelvin.
What is absolute zero Kelvin?
Zero, by definition.
Right, so 9.4 degrees Kelvin. From what my memory remembers that Cooper discovered that when it was 7 degrees Fahrenheit above absolute zero is when the effect started to occur.
It depends on the material. I think the first superconducting metal was mercury. That might have been what he was talking about. Also, in addition, they call that Cooper pairs, where two electrons couple in a lossless manner and just kind of glide through the superconductor without any resistance.
Yeah. Theoretically, there'll never be any dissipation of the energy. But does the energy actually pick up in any degree, given that it's being lent a positive ion?
No, it doesn't interact. The nature of Cooper pairs is that there's no thermodynamic friction or interaction with the electrons and the materials there. It's kind of the super pair couplings seem to kind of Teflon coat, if you'll suffer the metaphor, for the whole thing. So as long as you can maintain the temperature, the current will go round and round forever.
Is there an analogy here with superfluidity?
Well, not a good one. Superfluidity is a condition of a fluid that demonstrates no viscosity. So I guess if you want to kind of consider viscosity versus resistance, you could sort of make a case for that. but it's more of a fluidic phenomena than an electromagnetic one.
Yeah, Roger. Well, yes, two different phenomena. But the lack of resistance being the idea. Okay, well, that's interesting. If Paul is still here, I wanted to ask him, what is the planet that is so constantly visible at this time of night in the eastern sky? Because I keep looking at it out my window every night now, and I'm wondering if it's Jupiter.
Okay. Boy, do I have it?
Sure.
Yeah, at sunset, you know, that one is Venus. But then if you look higher in the sky, again, it's going to be the next planet up that you're seeing is Saturn. Jupiter is actually not in view at this time. So that would be Saturn. If you look, I think it was maybe about 30 degrees, 40 degrees to the, well, when the sun sets, Saturn was about 40 degrees up looking south, actually south, would that be south? I guess southwest, at that time. And then a couple of hours later, you know, maybe 9 o'clock at night, it would be very low in the western sky. That's my guess. Back to you.
Yeah, I'm looking at it right now, and it's about 30, 40 degrees up, and it's relatively bright. It's not a star. Okay, well, I'll have to actually get a scope and take a better look at it.
Okay, Brian, if you download this great app called Stellarium, if you download that app and you work with that, it's probably the best one that you could have. It'll show stars, it'll show the planets, it'll show you, you know, where the moon is. It's really good. After you download it, you take it and you take your phone, you put it up over your head, and you move it around, and you put it back down again. It'll show you landscape, you know, not your landscape, but it'll show, you know, flat landscape. I think there's a barn or something in the distance. But anyway, if you look in the distance, if you're looking south, it'll have an S, and then you could rotate it. You know, you could turn around and point it anywhere you want. You can point it at the sky. And you can point to it, you know, at that star that you're looking at. It'll say, you know, say the name of that star. It's really a good app, Stellarium.
Okay, Paul, thanks a lot, USL on Stellarium. I'll check it out. My name is Gary, by the way, K-A-T-U-T-F. Let me kick it back to Roy.
Okay, very good, Gary. Thank you again for your participation. We like questions, we like comments, we like to talk science. So I appreciate your participation, as Paul Wald, every Sunday. Anyone with any, let me point out another little thing. The Methuselah star is not visible to the naked eye. My understanding is if you have a decent binocular, you can see it. Certainly with a telescope you can see it, but I think with the naked eye, unless you're Superman, you can't quite make it out. But I just wanted to add that. Anyway, anyone with any other questions or comments for tonight, please, if you do, hit that push to talk and tell me them.
WB2BXO.
Yes, Frank, how are you? What can I do for it tonight?
Okay, as usual, kind of curious as to how you did on 10 meters with all the contest chaos. I I found the whole experience kind of frustrating because it seems somebody attached an AI to so-called CW skimmers that create the CW packet, CW DX bots automatically. And tried to do that with sideband and got some rather weird results. Go ahead.
All right, 1 second. I'm at. Just wanted to go to Gary. One. I just got my phone. I just wanted to confirm that that is that. I'm looking at the Stellarium right now. Back to you, Roy.
Okay, very good. Thank you, Paul. Right. It was inevitable. You know, people are going to hook up AI to things. I was talking to Ham. He's doing another thing that has receivers and hooked up to AI to recognize audio. And I was asking him, you know, what kind of accuracy are you getting with single sideband? Because, you know, frequency modulation with full capture, you know, maybe you have the fidelity to have a decent kind of translation into text. But, you know, single sideband is a mess, and you know, I don't think AI is up to it yet. And he agreed that he also used subchannels that generate some text fields as well to augment the AI stuff. So it's inevitable. It's, you know, we're just going to have to deal with it. As far as 10 meters, good and bad news. Good news is propagation was fantastic, and the whole thing was open. The bad news was that the contesters were using every single kilocycle there was. I could not find, you know, a kilocycle and a half to call my own. So it wasn't much of a net, unfortunately. But hopefully the contesters had a really nice time, and next week the contest will be over, and hopefully the propagation will still be decent. So I look forward to next Sunday.
Actually, next week is ARRL CW sweepstakes. So the major contest next weekend will not bother you in the phone band. Go ahead.
Good, good. I mean, just from the record, last year the same exact thing happened to me. It was a CQDX worldwide contest, and I couldn't find any place to park myself without QRMing and annoying contesters. So I think this is kind of the biggest hurdle in the year to deal with when the sunspot activity is good and the propagation is good. So hopefully I won't have this problem until next fall.
Well, you've got the 10-meter contest in December. I think that's the middle of December. And then, of course, ARRL DX sideband in February. And probably a couple of others I'm forgetting about. But off the top of my head, those are the big ones that may cause you some grief. Go ahead.
Okay, I mean, it's like the weather, you know. There's not much you can do about it, so you just deal with it as best you can. If there's no place to call home, then you call it a day. Again, last year, this was the only thing that really put a big bump into the net. So there have been other contests before, but not quite with the same fervor, if you will. The place was an insane asylum. And strangely enough, I was looking at 20 meters, and, you know, it was active, but it wasn't insane. So I don't know. There's something, I guess, special about the CQDX worldwide when propagation conditions are good on 10.
W portion of 20 was crazy.
Oh, okay. When I looked at it at 11 o'clock, it was active, but I wouldn't, you know, if you looked at 10 meters, it just like there was no straight line anyplace.
I couldn't get a signal out unless I was a contester, so I just turned it off.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes you get the bear, and sometimes the bear gets you. So, you know, there's always next Sunday.
And thank you, Paul. I say Saturn, is that right?
QSL and Stellarium is it's the best app out there. You know what's really cool? If you zoom in on it, too, you see these old satellites going by. What are these? And if you keep zooming in a little bit more, they'll tell you what each satellite is. And with the thousands of stalling satellites up there, you know, 9 times out of 10, you'll zoom in and it'll say Starlink, you know, actually have the number of that satellite. You know, and then sometimes you zoom in and you find out it's a Russian satellite or, you know, or maybe the Hubble or something. But it's an amazing app. What I like about it, it's free, you know, and just terrific. Anyway, Roy, over to you.
Okie doke, let's be quiet for a little bit because Frank is coming in into here by EchoLink. So fast skiing kind of gets him caught on the other side. So everyone, stay tuned. Just listen.
The 10 meters, which people did that for me on 10 meters. what I was going to say is I'm not necessarily surprised by that because. The best frequency is always the frequency that's closest to the MUF. If the MUF is that high, 20 meters is actually not going to be as good as 10 meters. So it's not necessarily surprising that 10 meters was... better than 20, and of course 10 meters is a daytime band, so the Sirius contest is going to move up to 10 meters when it's open and move off 20, so that may that may contribute also. Well, go ahead.
Yeah, that is probably a factor as well. Well, I wish everyone good luck in the contest, and every so often I'll have a conversation with someone who's really contested type, and he'd say, well, you got to try it out, you know. First, if you didn't experience it, if you didn't give it a chance, then you don't know what you're missing. I don't know. I probably, if I ever unfortunately needed ambience, I would probably just listen to a contest instead.
Well, that's why God created the so-called the work bands, in this case, God being the, not really the FCC, but the ITU, and then the FCC authorized us to use the so-called work bands, because apparently the ARRL kind of created, I don't know whether it's a tradition, an IARU agreement or what, but for the most part, those bands are not used for contesting. So if you have the antennas to do it, you can move off to those bands and not be impacted by contests. So go ahead.
Oh, okay, good to know. I mean, I just have a 10-meter antenna, so I'm kind of stuck on one band.
You know, your 10-meter, I guess you can see whether your 10-meter antenna works on 12 meters. Unfortunately, obviously, it's harder to lengthen an antenna than shorten one to make it work on 12 meters. That's a thought. Maybe you get a CB antenna, which is actually cut for 11 meters, which may be close enough. But I don't think so, since 11 meters is still 27 megahertz, and 12 meters is, 24.9. Go ahead.
AC2GS. Yeah, my Sirio is a 5/8 wave. It's sort of designed for both 10 meters and 11 meter CB. It has an extendable little whip, so you put it down for 10 meters, and you pull it up to the other end for 11-meter operation. and it's, of course, down for 10.
So I don't know if I got through. I doubt it's practical to extend it a little more so it will work on 12 meters. As I said before, it's harder to extend an antenna than shorten.
Yeah, I'm happy with 10. You know, I'm not going to kind of... I mean, the big problem is getting up to the roof in the first place. So I get up on the roof and you know, waggle some extra length of wire to maybe get 12. I'm happy with my 10. I mean, someday, maybe I'll talk a couple of fine gentlemen into assisting me and climbing a tall ladder that I would get a nosebleed just looking at. And maybe I'll get another antenna up on the roof someday.
Yeah, at this point on the sunspot cycle, you know, 10 meters is, you know, is very, very good. You know, of course, if you want regional comms, you know, you get either very local or long haul on 10 meters. You still, you have, unless you get some sporadic E, you know, you get a big skip zone, which if you want to have a regional reg choose, I guess, can be really, really annoying to have.
Yeah, I mean, I've been through this before. I've been on the net during the sunspot minimum. You end up talking to occasionally some guy in Florida, occasionally some guy in Arizona, and that's about it. Otherwise, I mean, your GX stations are in New Jersey.
Yeah, the friend of mine on the West Coast only has 2015 and 10 and wanted to do a work to all states and had a hard time working the closer in states. So I think he probably had a bit of an advantage over the East Coast as the nearest western states are probably just about far enough away to occasionally get some decent propagation to them on 2015 and 10. Anyway, eventually he did succeed in getting worked all states with only the higher frequencies, and you know that's that's pretty good. It's probably actually more difficult to do on the higher frequencies from here, where a couple of the states are pretty close in and are going to skip over most of the time.
Yeah. Good for him. I'm not really a wallpaper chaser. I never really got into contesting. You know, I kind of perceive it as playing tag. I understand the enjoyment factor for it. I prefer conversation. I prefer the exchange of ideas, opinions, information in general. And, you know, just kind of reciting your call sign, your signal strength, and maybe a geolocator or something. I don't know. Doesn't really do much for me.
I think a lot of hams agree with you. And I do know, I kind of agree. It does seem kind of lame after a while. But I kind of started working on these awards when I was a kid. And, you know, sort of enjoy the challenge of finishing them, you know, before I'm finished, so to speak. Go ahead.
Now I think it's, if anything, unfortunately, it's diminishing returns. FT8 is a kind of fantastic technology, but as an experience, I mean, because I tried it, and I almost longed for a contest. It's very automated. Once upon a time, a gentleman was sitting in the chat room here on the TechNet, and he said, let me turn on my FT8 and see what happens. And he set his FT8 on autopilot, and he made a bunch of contacts, but at the end of the night, he kind of typed away at the chat room and said, I don't know, wasn't fun. I didn't even barely look at it, and it just did it itself.
Well, the thing I find quite interesting about FTA, I agree. You know, it's what sociologists would call counting coup. Just kind of, as you said, just kind of playing tag is another good expression for it. And it's even more so than on CW and phone, and it is highly automated. But from the point of view of what some people call ham science, it's interesting because you see, you see propagation because, first of all, because it works with very weak signals, and second of all, because everybody's more or less on one frequency, you see propagation you wouldn't see otherwise. And from that point of view, it's kind of interesting to work, say, last winter, work of a VK7, I always get the pronunciation wrong, Tasmania, south of, the small Australian state to the south of the continent, actually, very late at night. It's like, you wouldn't expect there to be a propagation path on 15 meters at, 4 or 5 hours after sunset during the winter. But it was, a solid FTA contact. Go ahead.
Yeah, but you have to remember, you're traveling below the noise floor, which always amazes me.
Yeah, I mean, that's interesting, but the point is the propagation is there. You wouldn't know that otherwise. So, I mean, there's some value added to that. Otherwise, I kind of agree. I kind of cut way back on the FTA because, it just seems chaotic often with everybody on the same frequency. It's kind of interesting. Guys kind of stake out the discrete frequency in fox hunt mode, and you get to work the guy even when he's below the noise level. And especially if there's very little competition, if most guys have worked already. So that's the redeeming value of FTA, is it seems to have some value in terms of learning a little about propagation that you might not know otherwise. Go ahead.
Okay, yeah. I mean, Joe Taylor has done a lot of work in figuring out propagation conditions. You know, he has those other utilities that both receive and transmit short little bursts of signal and then post them on websites and such. So he's a lot into, measuring propagation and such. So it's all good. You know, if it makes you happy, I think that's the most important aspect. I hopefully am never going to be a guy with a clipboard who tells you this is ham radio and this isn't ham radio. And, stop doing the stuff that isn't ham radio.
Well, there are guys who try to do that from time to time. So I don't think it's happened in a number of years. I think from time to time in the last century, the FCC has stepped in and said, this isn't ham radio, you're not going to do this. As with broadcasting in the 1920s, when some hams were doing broadcasting. I don't know if there's a more recent example of that. That's the one that comes to mind. But, there are occasionally people who step in and say, hey, this just isn't ham radio. Go ahead.
Okay, well, I think people are usually that remark is not directed at someone who is operating on RF and doing something deleterious to fellow hams. It's usually someone who's using the internet as part of the equation and just annoying guys who don't like computers either, to access and such. So I don't know. It's problematic. I mean, if you haven't been told that you're what's wrong with this hobby, then you haven't probably been working the radio enough.
Agreed.
Yeah, I've had this discussion with people who complain about me, working awards using a remote site, and there are some awards that don't really allow it, but some do, and it seems like a legitimate mode of operation. Some hands say, well, if you're using a remote site, you're not prepared for emergencies. Well, I'm not sure about that, because most of the time the emergency is not going to be at your location. And what you want to do, perhaps, is be able to work a low-power station in the disaster zone. And maybe a good way to do that with that is access to more than one transmitter site transceiver site, technically, to see where you can hear the person who has the emergency. I mean, that's the way it's done in the commercial world, so, why not? So I think even, there is, again, some value added, as they say in business, to a hybrid version of ham radio. You go ahead.
Yeah, I would agree with you, Frank. But, some guys are stubborn about it all. Anyway, always a pleasure to talk with you, Frank. I don't want to take any more time away from poor Paul. So I thank you, as always, for your participation, Frank. I wish you well, and I hope we'll be able to chat again next Sunday.
Yeah, very good. I kind of get carried away. I usually kind of pass it back to you to go back to Neptune. One last comment, and we can come back to it. I did get the current version of the Meta Ray-Ban sunglasses, which do not try to project images into your eyes. I really want that version when it comes down in price and becomes commercialized to try it. But the current version simply snaps a still picture and uses an AI to describe the picture or read the text and stuff. And just trying, it does seem to have a tendency to hallucinate, but at times it works very well. Anyway, we can, I'll try to play with it more during the week and give you a little more on that. I just got the thing. 7-3 for now. We'll see what Paul has to say. I'm real interested in that too. WB2BXO.
Very good. We'll talk about it next Sunday. I mentioned earlier Meta or Facebook, whatever you want to call it, has a prototype of a much more sophisticated glass. And it's only cost $10,000. Not that anyone's buying it, because Meta is just called it a prototype because the optical waveguide cost something like $8,000 to build, and not each build worked correctly. So there's a bit of technology that they got to iron out. So thank you, as always, Frank. And now it is time for Paul, WS2N, with the space news.
Thanks, Roy. ATTGS, WS2N, for the SpaceNet report. And, by the way, you guys are right about you could have like a net control, like the hurricane net. And the guy that's doing the net control is nowhere near the hurricane, But he's kind of trying to contact people that might be there. So, Frank could be a net control on a remote station for a hurricane or any kind of storm. As far as the SpaceNet report goes, the Japanese, I believe it's tomorrow or the next day, they're going to launch their fourth H-3 rocket. H-3 is they call it a medium lift rocket, but it's a large rocket, liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. And they call it H-3. They used to have the H-1. And that was not what it was. Then they had the and then it was H2B. So they flew probably 100 versions of that over the years. They also were liquid hydrogen and liquid oxygen. The H2A was strictly used for satellites that they would launch, and the H-2B was strictly used for cargo to be sent to the International Space Station. They do it once a year. They completed around 9 flights to the space station. They don't do it anymore because they're working on a new upgraded cargo version, you know, to lift even heavier stuff up and you know, bigger volume things up. So now they have the H-3, which is less expensive to develop, more powerful than the previous ones. But it took them a couple extra years to get these things going. But now they're up to 8, which is great. And it's great for NASA because not only will they eventually launch future cargo vehicles to the International Space Station and maybe future commercial space stations, but they also have contracts to eventually send cargo out to the Gateway space station that will be located around the moon. So, you know, there's a couple of cargo companies, rocket companies that are on the books, and one of them is this company. So it's good to see the H-3 starting to fly on a regular basis. A little shaky, for the first year, but now they're doing good. Let me drop it. Okay, and let me just see if anybody has any comments before I can continue on. My next topic is going to deal with the United Launch Alliance.
This is Kilo Echo 2 Alpha Juliet Uniform. Paul, I have returned.
Welcome back, Charlie. Yeah, we missed you for a couple of weeks. Did you get to see a rocket take off down there? There was one that just went off, I think, 2 days ago. Back to you.
Let me tell you, I stopped at Publix. I got a nice chicken dinner. I went out on the ocean. It was 85 and sunny. And just as I finished dinner, you know what happened? They canceled the flight. I drove 4 hours, and it got canceled. I was not a happy camper.
Yeah, that's a common problem. And for the last couple of weeks, they've been a little slow. There have not been that many going up one after the other. And that tends to happen toward the end of the year. You know, but you have to hit it just right. But all during the year, I would say every four days, there was a launch. So, okay. Better luck next time, Charlie. I know that one just went up 1 or 2 days ago. That was another Starlink mission. But the one that was canceled, I don't remember which one that was. How many days ago was that?
That was, hang on, I wrote it down. Let me see. Good grief. I was there on October 19th. And just as I get down, and I didn't know, I had no way of knowing it was canceled. It wasn't launched until the 21st, and I was checking the skies all over Tampa, and I couldn't see a thing.
Yeah. I don't think that was. That might have been the heavy. That might have been the one that went to Jupiter, or now on the way to Jupiter. You roll up a clipper. Might have been that one. And, probably that one. You know, actually, they should have been earlier, but because of the hurricane, they were really delayed.
Yes, that's correct. The storm, they still didn't dig up from the storm. But as far as this Japanese rocket is scheduled to go off October 30th at 4:30 a.m. And this is an X-band for government use, military use, for the satellite for military use.
Okay, yeah, I just checked that the other day. I knew it was going to go up in a couple of days. So, very good. Yeah, that's, Japan got really good at it with the old H-2s. But now the H-3s has replaced both the H-1 and the H-2. Not crushing the H-2A and the H-2B that they've been flying. So now this one is less expensive, more powerful, and it's going to take over for Japan. Like I said before, it's going to be used for cargo, going to the space station. But even better than that, once the space station is in orbit around the moon, the Gateway, it's going to be one of the companies, one of the countries that are involved in sending cargo to the Gateway space station. Another company I'm very happy to see, it looks like they're going to get their certification, is United Launch Alliance, the ULA. That's just really a combination of Boeing and Lockheed. They've been at this for, I think, since 2007 or so, working together on building these rockets. And collectively, they have built the Vulcan rocket, and it turns out to be a very successful rocket so far. They needed to get a certification from the U.S. government to launch government contracts. You know, they launched geosynchronous, they launched NASA stuff. They really needed to do this for that certification. They needed two flights. Anytime you have a new rocket, it has to have at least two flights. And it looks like they're going to get their certification. The first flight was a little over a year ago, and that was very successful. It had a payload to go to the moon. Payload itself had nothing to do with them, and that one didn't work out. That was by Peregrine. But the rocket itself, it's a heavy lift rocket, bigger than this H-2 thing, or the H-3 thing I was talking about from Japan. Anyway, they launched from Launch Complex 41 down in Florida, and eventually they're going to also be launching from California, from Vandenberg, with these rockets as well. But what's nice about them is they're two brand new engines that they use, and they're built by Blue Origin. They have the D4 engines, which are liquid natural gas, LNG, as opposed to liquid methane. You know, they're close, but they're not exactly the same. It's actually less expensive to run liquid natural gas. And it's the first rocket, and like I said, around a year or so ago, was very successful. And then they just launched one recently that had no payload on it because they didn't want to wait around. They want to get certified, when I say they, the ULA. And it turns out that rocket went off. And the main rocket, the Vulcan, was successful. There was a problem with one of the boosters, but they seem to. It looks like they made the government happy about that. It's just one little glitch that has nothing to do with the ULA rocket. It has to do with the booster, and the booster is made by Northrop Grumman. So there's no problem with the Vulcan rocket. So the new Vulcan engines, the V4 engines built by Blue Origin, ran perfectly. Let me drop it. Which should really be great because Blue Origin is going to be launching a really big, heavy lift vehicle called the New Glenn. That was supposed to go off this month, too. if things would have went right, you would have gotten to see the first new Glen Rocket go up. But Charlie, but that was delayed as well, and that's going to be going up this coming month in November. They had some more work they needed to do to launch that. So that's the new Glen. That has not too big BE-4 engines like the Vulcan has, but it's got the same BE-4 engines that Blue Origin is building, and they're putting 7 of these things into the new Glen to launch that rocket. And it's going to be I guess twice as powerful than the Falcon 9. And the second stage, they're running BE-3 engines, which is not liquid natural gas, but it's liquid hydrogen, liquid oxygen. And that's really the same engine that they've been using for years now on what they call the New Shepard. The New Shepard is the one that presently launches from West Texas on suborbital flights. They don't make it to orbit. But these engines, you know, it's actually only one engine that they use on the New Shepard, and it's the BE-3 engine. And very successful. It takes off, puts the crew into suborbital flight. Crew comes down on parachutes, you know, in a capsule, and the booster itself comes back and lands about 2 miles away from where it took off. The three engine that they use on that, they're putting 2 of them on the second stage of the New Glenn rocket. So each BE-3 engine gives you over 120,000 pounds of thrust. So they're going to be looking at roughly 240,000 pounds of thrust on the second stage alone, which is just terrific. It's equal to the amount that SpaceX does on their second stage. Any comments? WS1.
Yeah, I had one, Paul. SpaceX crew, 8 astronauts hospitalized with medical issues after splashdown, has been released.
Yeah, that's crew 8. They were on the International Space Station for over 6 months, and they were actually supposed to return a couple of weeks ago, about 3 weeks ago. But because of all these hurricanes and also some rough weather in the Atlantic and in the Gulf of Mexico, NASA delayed their return. So, you know, they finally got to come back on a SpaceX Crew Dragon vehicle. They call it Crew 8. I mean, it's the 8th flight to the International Space Station by SpaceX for NASA. You know, they launched some other people up there too on private missions from Axiom. But NASA, these are all contracted by NASA to go up. And there were, like you said, 4 people that went up and came back. Michael Barrett, Janine Epps, and also you have Matthew Dominic, let me drop it, as well as a Russian cosmonaut, Alexander Grenbegin. He goes up every SpaceX crew that goes up to the International Space Station now has to have a Russian on it, and just like Soyuz rocket launches from Kazakhstan by the Russian, we always have to have one American on board. That's the deal right now. So that's why he was on board. It landed safely in the Gulf of Mexico. When I say landed, they have a splashdown for SpaceX. And whatever waves were there, they were not you know, big waves. They always wait for calm, you know, pretty calm water before they bring these people back. SpaceX has their own, like, SpaceX Navy. They go out there with a ship, and they fish this thing out of the water, put the whole vehicle onto the deck. They open the door, and the crew came out one at a time, and they see, right? And they, right away, they bring them inside the ship, and they get an initial checkup by the medical officers. And there was something that they didn't like about the crew, and that's yet to be released. So they fly the crew back to Pensacola, Florida, where there's a hospital there, and all four were actually admitted, and apparently they checked them out, and they didn't like the condition of one of them. So three of them left, and the one stayed behind. And NASA, and I guess Roscosmos, is not releasing the name of the astronaut that stayed behind. I've read one article, and I think since this happened, that person has been released as well, but I can't confirm that. It's like a big secret. So we'll have to wait and see. So I'm curious to find out what happened, you know. Was it, you know, when they landed, you know, they do land in water. You know, did they all get seasick at the same time? You know, was it something that they ate before they left, you know? Did they all have the fish? You know, what happened to these people? And I haven't heard a word yet, Charlie, but I'm sure, I guess by next week we'll hear what happened, you know. I mean, when they got off, they said they were okay. It was a regular, you know, fine landing, they said. So what went wrong? I know they were all up there for over 6 months, but we've had people up there for over a year. And they have not been hospitalized. It's the first time I remember somebody coming back and actually being hospitalized. We'll have to wait and see if it's Michael Barrett or Janine Epps or the Russian or the other fellow, Matthew Dominic. Find out what the problem was. Anyway, back to you, Charlie. WS1.
It was a guy who mentioned that he looked out the window and he wasn't sure what he was looking at in the sky. I had, I'm trying to get it up now, sky map installed on my telephone. And let me tell you, it tells me where everything is, what I'm looking at. All I have to do is just point my phone in the direction. I love it. I love this sky map.
Yeah, I still like sky map. I still do. There's another one I mentioned earlier tonight to Gary called Stellarium. That you download that app, and that, to me, it's the best. It's just terrific. You want to look at the sky. Pointed out a star, pointed out a planet, pointed out, you know, anything you're curious about, and it'll actually show you, you know, as if you're looking at the sky, and tell you what it is. You know, when we had this comet that we were supposed to see. By the way, I tried with binoculars and everything.
Next time, complete
time. It's, you know, been multiple days, but this particular app. I mean, they actually have the comet's name on there. Which is great, you know. In other words, they must update it, you know, on a regular basis. And it's called Stellarium. Charlie, you should try that. Do you want me to spell it for you?
Take a look at it. I've never heard of it, but I'll take a look at it.
Yeah, okay, the Stellarium. When I first heard about it years ago, I thought it was Star, you know, but it's not. It's S-T-E, S-T-E-L-L-A-R-I-U-M. You put that, you know, Stellarium app. It's free, and it's really good. And once you download it, you know, you could hold it. You know, it's going to ask you for your location, or, you know, sometimes you just, you know, say yes, you know, if it wants to use your phone, you know, for location or something, you say yes. And once you have this thing, you point it any direction you want, say point it to the north, and, you know, there'll be like a little red N in the distance, north, and then you move it to the west, and you'll see a W. And to make that work, you'll see it in the initial directions. You know, you download it, and then you take that phone, and you take it, you put it over your head, and then you just move it around, you know, twist it a little bit, and then you bring it back down. It's using the GPS on your phone and compass to, you know, it's setting itself up. So this way it knows what it's looking at. So wherever you point it, it's like the sky map, but this one is even better. Back to you, Charles.
I also have Next Space Flight installed on my phone. So I can click it if I'm... I intend to be back down in Tampa area after the new year. It tells me next space flight, where it's being launched, when it's being launched, and if it is canceled, it will tell me.
Very good, yeah. I use spaceflight.com. I use... Yeah. And they used to have, you know, you used to look at that, and the calendar used to go out months, you know, 4, 5, 6 months. Now, I don't know, it only goes out a month or so. So I thought that was kind of weird. But we'll see. I just want to mention talked about the Gateway. There's actual hardware that they're building for Gateway now that will be eventually be sent up. In orbit, it'll stay there and wait for a crew. You know, the Gateway is the space station that NASA plans on putting out there with the help of other countries that are also involved in that. So it's going to be like an international effort. But anyway, they have astronauts actually test, you know, in a mock-up of the Gateway and poking around in there and seeing what it's going to be like to work and live inside. So we'll see. Pretty exciting times coming up. Anyway, I'm looking at the time. I'll shut it down for now. We'll be back next week. Talk about other things like the neutron rocket. It's another one that they plan on launching next year. We'll talk about that a little bit next year. Next week. That's by Rocket Lab. A complete reusable vehicle, 100%. The reason I want to mention that, Dr. Roy put that on his website as one of the topics, and you can see this gigantic machine that they use, the 3D printer that's making the parts of the neutron rocket. It's pretty incredible. I mean, this thing's like 4 stories tall. You know, when I say this thing, this 3D machine, so it's pretty cool. Anyway, 73 guys, and we'll turn it over to Roy, AC2GS, WS2N for the Space Net Report for the TechNet. Back to you, Roy.
AC2GS here. Our rebels now are done. Thank you, Paul. Thank you for the Space Net Report. Thank you for all that you do for the technical net and all that you do for the club. We all appreciate it. I especially appreciate it. And I appreciate everyone who came on board and hit that push to talk tonight, participated. Participation makes the breaks, these technical nets. So thank you to each and every one. As always, want to remind people, Dick.